Hi, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. And I'm on to yourself.
Yeah, I'm all right. Where are you at the moment?
I'm in my office, which is in my garden at home. A number of years ago, decided to build an office there. So I literally do work from home.
Okay. So are you, which part of the UK are you in there at the moment? Sorry.
Devon.
Ah, oh, you're in Devon.
Yeah, that's where I live.
Oh, and
yeah.
You drink cider from...
I'd rather not with most of it, actually, Monty. A lot of it is so rustic. If it was a wine, it would be condemned, you know? It's got sort of twigs and bits of beak in it still. So it's really very unpleasant. So I don't drink much cider, I'm afraid.
Is it that bad? Yeah, it is a little bit Neolithic down there. And I'm joking.
No, it's you're pretty accurate. You're pretty on the ball there, Monty. It can be a bit.
All right, should we start then? Ready to rock and roll?
Yeah, sure. Whenever you are, Monty.
Italian Wine Podcast. Cin Cin with Italian wine people.
Hello, this is the Italian Wine Podcast. My name is, I was going to call myself Michael Garner.
Well, you can pretend to be me if you like. I don't think it'll get you very far, but...
You had that effect on me. That's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Hello, this is the Italian Wine Podcast. Done it again.
You're corpsing, Monty, already.
Yeah, I was. I was in the Brunello Vineyards this morning, and it was the beautiful light and wind and all the rest of it, seeing people snipping grapes. Now the hard work begins. I'm me actually being able to get more than four words together out at the same time. Hello, this is the Italian Wine Podcast. My name is Monty Walden. My guest today is Michael Garner. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Mark, how would you describe yourself? I first met you, came across you in book form when I bought the book that you wrote, Tar and Roses on Barolo. With Paul Merritt all those years ago in the early 1990s.
Yeah, published in 1990, in fact, yeah.
And I read that book because I was working in a shop at the time in London with a chap called Chris Donaldson, who was studying for his Master of Wine, and he recommended that book, and he did pass his MW first time round. And I think it was, yeah, certainly one of the first wine books I ever read. It was a great read.
Really?
Yeah, it was, honestly.
Wow.
I've got it on my desk.
Have you really?
Yeah, hardback. And you with...
It's worth a lot of money, apparently, on whatever it's called, on Amazon or eBay or whatever.
Right, well, that was the end of the podcast. Thanks very much, Michael.
That's nice to speak to you, as always, Monty. Yeah.
Anyway, that was how I came across you. So why the fascination with Piemonte, and also how did you get into wine in the first place? Because you were, apart from being a writer, you also... have a small wine merchant business.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, more of an agent sort of style broker. We just sell the wine from a few wineries in the UK on an ex-seller basis. I suppose that's more kind of brokerage agent time work than being a wine merchant as such. Although, what is the distinction? I'm not too sure. Yeah, I call myself a wine merchant. Why not? How did I get into the wine trade? Totally by accident, Monty. I was between teaching jobs. I used to teach and working in a bar and wasn't really enjoying it. And via a friend I knew, I got what I thought at the time was going to be a temporary job as a cellar boy in Odbins. And anyway, to cut a long story short, we... soon after that, learned that my wife was pregnant, and I thought I'd better start trying to be a bit more of a serious human being and make sure that I could look after my wife and the beginnings of a family. So I needed to stick at something. I stuck at wine. So that's how I got into the wine trade.
Where were you based at the time? Were you based in the UK?
Yes, I was in the beautiful city of Bath, if you remember Bath. Near Bristol, beautiful Roman city. Not Roman city, but it has a Roman parts to it, as you probably know. Really beautiful. I just moved there, and I was between teaching jobs, and this job came up in Odbins as a cellar boy. So yeah, I went for it. I needed a job at the time, so I stuck with it, and there you go. Worked for Odbins for a number of years, and just kind of worked my way through the wine trade to where I am at the moment.
Oh, Michael, we should say something about odd bins, because we've got an international audience. A lot of them won't know what odd bins is or was.
Oh, right. Fair enough. Okay.
It was a sort of a cutting edge chain of wine shops in the United Kingdom, which introduced many wines to the UK, in terms of especially Australia and Californian wines and New Zealand wines. They're very sort of avant-garde, as well as some of the classics. So what was your role?
Yeah, I got a job in the Bath Odd Bins, Bath branch of Odd Bins, just shifting cases around the cellar. And as you rightly say, it was very much a cutting edge outfit at the time, bringing wines into the UK that no one had ever heard of. So it was a very exciting time in the trade, because it was kind of breaking the mold. Before that, the wine trade was a very, very traditional and conservative business. To some extent, it still is as well. But Odd Bins, I think, were the first people to sort of take a wholly new and much more dynamic approach to the wine business. And I know at the time that it's sort of spawned a lot of people who've gone on to sort of bigger things in the wine trade. I think of perhaps, you know, Andrew Shaw, maybe, is the buying director for, who I know you know, Andrew, buying director for whatever they're called. I can't remember the name of the company. Never mind, I'm sure it'll come to you or me or someone at some stage. And various other people as well who did their apprenticeship in the trade in odd bins, shall we say. Bibendum, that's where Andrew works. So yeah, a number of people. It was a sort of proving ground for a number of people. Yeah.
So at the moment, obviously that was quite a long time ago. So you worked in that shop, you got the wine bug. How long did it take you to establish your own business in the wine trade? How many years did that take?
Blimey, that probably took 20 years. Before I actually had my own company, yes. But in the meantime, there was something much more important happening in my life, which, you know, I'd fathered three sons by then, and they were and are remain the centre of my world. So I kind of put my own dreams on a back burner, if you like, and just focused on making sure I could house, clothe and feed my family. That was my first priority.
So how did you do that, though?
Well, by sort of working for larger companies who paid me better salary.
Wine companies or other companies?
No, wine companies, always within the wine trade, yeah. Because it would have been perhaps folly to have tried to jump ship, with the responsibilities that I had.
If you're a younger member of the wine trade, or sends you an email or knocks on your door, says, "I want to get into the wine trade, what's the best way of doing it?" What would your answer be, seeing as you stumbled in there by accident almost, a little bit like me?
Pass, I guess. I wouldn't know. It's not necessarily a... Someone came up to me, "How do I get a start in the wine trade?" I'd probably suggest go and look for something else. it's a great trade, but I think... No, I can't answer that. I really can't. I wouldn't know how to advise someone it, because, you know, if you're talking about someone's kind of life and dreams, the last thing I'd want to do is ruin them.
Okay. I was going to say, I would say go and get a job on a vineyard, learn how it's made first, and then get yourself a job in an importer or a wine shop or a wine bar or something like that, so you can actually taste wines from other...
Yeah, sure. Okay, I can appreciate that, Monty, but that's not an opportunity that's open to everybody, is it? I got a job sort of, you know, at the lowest level of the wine trade. And I would say if someone can afford to, you know, do that, being if someone's in a fortunate enough position to be able to do that, to be able to just, you know, dedicate their life to working in a vineyard and working their way through the wine trade, that's wonderful. Then that's probably the best way of doing it. But I don't think those are opportunities open to everybody. So there you go.
Yeah. So, for the companies that you work for, were you the buyer? Were you the negotiator? Were you what was your exact role in these wine companies?
Oh right, yeah, a bit of everything. I got a kind of lucky break. My lucky break was, I think that was sort of in the I'm not sure how long I'd been in the wine trade. Probably about 4 or 5 years. But I joined a company that was called Grierson Blumenthal. which was the wine and spirits arm of the Forte Empire, so Rocco Forte. And at the time, within Grierson and Blumenthal, there was a division called Italian Wine Agencies, which was headed up by a wonderful guy, a real character called Richard Hobson, a master of wine who sadly died rather young. He was at the time branching out and forming other divisions like French wine agencies and Hispanic wine agencies. And because by then I'd already sort of started to focus on Italian wine, he brought me in and I started really running Italian wine agencies for him. And I suppose there we're looking at kind of the mid-80s. So if you'd like me to continue with my sort of own personal history in the trade, I worked for them for a number of years until Trust House Forte was sort of broken up and sold off to its various divisions. I think the wine arm, which I left when the breakup took place, went on to become Matthew Clark, if I'm not much mistaken. And some other people went off to other companies as well. I then worked for a number of years through my other great mentor in the wine trade, which is a guy called Renato Trestini, who you may have heard about. Sadly, he died a few years ago as well. And he gave me free rein to sort of do what I want, and which is great fun. So I worked there for a couple of years, well, probably more actually, 3 or 4 years, until we were bought up by another company. I can't remember the name of them either. Well, I stayed for a few more years and then thought, sod this, I'm going to do it on my own, you know. So with my co-author, Paul Merritt.
Were your responsibilities also going to Italy to buy wine and or to source wine, to build relationships?
Yeah, very much. Yes, the whole package really, sort of sourcing and selling, very much so. I've always kind of felt that you need a thorough grounding in the trade to be any good at it. So not only was I buying and selling wine and talking about it and drinking it, but I also taught for a number of years for the WSET. I used to teach diploma to people on Italian wine. So I've always thought that the kind of, to understand the trade properly, you've got to become immersed in all aspects of the business. So, you know, I suppose I've been very lucky that I've kind of done every, you know, most things. You know, I've made a bit of wine and stuff like that as well, because, you know, you really, to get to the bottom of a wine, you need to get to know the grapes and the vineyards and the people, the whole story.
I mean, do you think from those days then and what's going on today, do you think, we're talking about the wine trade here, not consumers, but wine trade people in the United Kingdom, which obviously is still an important market for Italy, how do you see the level of knowledge amongst the professional elite in the UK now compared to then? Was it a little bit more sort of fun and a little bit less precise in those days compared to now? Has the fun gone out of it?
Certainly. Yeah. I don't know about that. It's still, you know, you're in the wine trade as well, Monty. You know what a fun trade it can be. Still be and is, not just can be. It was back in those days, back sort of when I was kind of growing up in the wine trade, which I suppose is the 1980s. Italy got incredibly short shrift. It was the butt of the joke area of the wine trade. People just thought Italian wine was, you know, on a lower level, and it was dismissed as, you know, a commodity product that was bought and sold on price, and quality wasn't really part of the equation. And so the people's understanding of Italian wine was at an all-time low within the trade. So, as I said, I think the British trade in particular always was fairly insular and conservative. That has broken down to some extent now, and thank God for it. It certainly needed to.
So what changed? I mean, you know, I totally agree with what you're saying. I mean, in those days, I was a little bit after you, you know, this obsession with Bordeaux and also to Burgundy to a certain extent. And obviously Italy being a behemoth got pretty short shrift, because it was maybe seen as inconsistent, but also lacking seriousness. You know, there weren't those Chateau Latours and Petruses that you could, names that you could reel off from Italy. But that's changed, hasn't it? And how have you seen that?
Well, I think those great names were always there. It's just that people were blinkered. As you say, they had an obsession with French wines. And I think, you know, the gradual acceptance of, for example, Australian wine made a big difference. People began, if somewhat grudgingly, to admit that there were people other than the French who could make good wine. And even back then, in the 70s, there were great names in wine. And Piero Pan made his first cru in 1971, his first cru Suave, Calvarino. I remember one of the biggest memories of my wine life was in the early 1980s, and it's what really turned me on to Italian wine, so you've got a scoop here, Monty. I remember being in the cellars, not the current cellars, but the old cellars of Giovanni Conterno, Roberto's dad. I remember tasting 10-year-old Monfortino from the barrel. This was in the early 80s, and being blown away by how good it was. It was extraordinary. And yet, you know, you tried to tell some of the, you know, the wine establishment, in the sort of the British wine trade establishment, about some of these wines, and they just dismissed you out of hand. So, you know, but Italian wine, I'm grateful for sort of giving me a crusade, because I've always had a kind of an evangelical side to my nature, which the Italian one.
You like supporting, it's kind of like the underdog, I think, rather than evangelical. You have a real sense of fairness. You know, you are fair. You like the idea of fairness.
Yeah, of course I do. But I don't know. If you see it that way, you're probably a better judge of that than I am, Monty, because, you know, I always thought I had an evangelical side, but perhaps I don't.
But in your view, it wasn't fair that these, albeit good wines from, say, Bordeaux, were getting all the applause, and these as good, if not even better, wines from, for example, Piemonte, as you cited, were really being ignored. So, but apart from your indignation about that,
that's very true, very true.
But it also showed you there were niches to explore, which is what you and your business partner, then business partner Paul Merritt, did by publicising. It wasn't your book on Barolo Taran Roses. Wasn't just a book about the region. It was basically a book about saying this is an exceptional region and people should wake up. Because it's not the only great region in Piemonte or in Italy. That was the message I certainly got from that book when I read it. I mean, I was so into Bordeaux then. I'd learned everything I had by living in Bordeaux and all the rest. It was very Bordeaux-centric. And that book showed me there is another side, not just another side, but many, many other sides to the wine industry. And, of course, you say the Australian tsunami and the New Zealand arrival and the California and all the rest of it. It suddenly became exciting in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And it, what was exciting again, repeat, was it was excitement of the old classics that had been ignored, that they could then come to the fore as they hadn't done before. And you were a part of that.
Yeah, that's as may be. But I think it's just really the wine trade growing up, Monty, as much as anything else, you know, and becoming a little less insular and becoming a little more open-minded. Yeah, and it needs people to sort of...
With consumers as well.
Oh, definitely, definitely, absolutely, yeah. Because wine for... As an everyday drink for people in the UK is something of the last just of the last couple of decades, isn't it? Really, for you know the normal guy in the street. When I was young, certainly I never drank wine at all. Maybe once a year, and you know, at Christmas or my father's birthday or something. I didn't know what wine was really until you know my early 20s.
Mm-hmm. So, in terms of Italy, when obviously the changes that gone on over the last 20 years, these huge changes. What are your favourite areas or grape varieties or even wine styles now? You know, if we could give you a free ticket to go across Italy, all expenses paid, you know, where would you be heading to and why?
Personal preference, you mean? Are you asking me as a consumer rather than anything else there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The man in the street, not...
The man in the street, okay. My current favourite area, and it's great that even at my sort of venerable old age, I can still sort of feel stirred as much as I feel stirred at the moment is certainly the wines of the Alto Adige. I used to be involved commercially with the Alto Adige in the mid-80s when I was working with Richard Hobson. And back then, the wines were kind of mainly bulk wines, a lot of red from Schiava sent up to sort of Austria and Germany. And everything was sort of, you know, pretty much a commodity product. And the way that region has turned itself around in less than 30 years and is now clearly the most exciting region in Italy, Europe, and possibly the world for white wines, because I think that they're that good. The white wines of the Alto Adige are just absolutely out this world these days. I'm still a huge fan of Valpolicella. Really good Valpolicella for me is one of the most underrated red wines out there. And, you know, depending on the size of the check you gave me, I'd go and explore somewhere else as well. There are still, I've never been to Sardinia. I'd love to go to Sardinia. But I've been to all the other wine-producing regions, I think. And they all have something there, Monty. You know it yourself that each region has, you know, a tiny sort of area making brilliant wines from some unheard-of grape variety. And that's the beauty of Italy. You can still go over there and discover that sort of thing. And these days, thankfully, there's a receptive enough audience out there to enable you to indulge yourself and also, you know, allow them sort of access to some of Italy's great enological treasures. And it is still a treasure chest, and it's still only partly explored. Am I mixing my metaphors there? But there you go.
What are the? Do you see any sort of key trends in Italian wine? In terms of winemaking or the rise of the previously unheard of native Italian grape varieties? What is exciting right now?
Going back to that sort of earlier point about, you know, what's changed, I think what I have noticed is that the Italians are perhaps making wines more for the sheer pleasure of making it rather than making it for someone else, if you like. They are looking at their own grape varieties, their own methods, and thinking, well, yeah, using these methods, we can get the most out of what we have, the raw materials that we have. They've reevaluated those raw materials and are now getting the best results out of them, which they didn't for a long time. You know, to be successful, you had to make Chardonnay or Cabernet or something or Syrah. And finally, you know, people woke up to the idea that Nebbiolo and Sangiovese were great grape varieties, as they are. There's no question of it. But you've noticed, as I have, Monty, that the really interesting aspect of Italian wines at the moment, I think, is in white wines. Angelo Gaia said about 10 years ago, didn't he, that the future of Italian wine was white. And people are still quite shocked by that. But, you know, he's quite a visionary, Angelo Gaia, isn't he? I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Are there any lesser-known grape varieties that you think are waiting to be discovered still by the wine trade, not necessarily in the UK, but in general? Any hidden gems that you, every time you taste that particular variety, think, oh, God, this is so underrated. I wish more people knew about it.
Sure. No, that's wow. Again, the world's your oyster there, Mr. Walden. So many. Grignolino. How good is Grignolino when it's on form? Same thing about Fraser. And that's just Piemonte. Back to the Alto Adige, Silvana. Silvana is so good when it's made well, you know, at altitude up in the Valle Isarco. I've tasted some Silvanas from up there that are just breathtaking. So, yeah, there are all sorts. That's just, you know, two regions. Corvino's capable of making great stuff. So is Verdicchio. But those are quite well known already. You're talking about the more obscure ones. Grignolino, certainly. Silvana, stuff like Pinot Bianco. How good is Pinot Bianco? Well made.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's very refreshing and sort of and it's gluggable and interesting, even though it hasn't got a huge amount of flavour.
It depends, you know, their flavour, you know, how essential is flavour? I tend to like wines that are sort of subtle and graceful and match well with food. And a lot of flavour in a wine doesn't always lend itself to that use. Just a thought for you to mull over.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, what was interesting when you said that in your sort of top areas, I mean, obviously Alto Adige is well known for its whites as it is for its reds, and then obviously Verdicchio is a white, and you've obviously talked about and Suave as well.
Yeah, I love Suave.
They've done a huge amount of work understanding their terroir and really getting those wines, you know, into sort of first class trajectory. In terms of your work as a journalist, you write for Decanter, many other publications, do you see any trends journalistically or pressure from editors or suggestions from editors regarding Italy? And what kind of assignments do you like getting, and what kind of assignments don't you like getting?
I'm in the fortunate position as a freelance journalist where, you know, I can be fairly sort of choosy about what assignments I take on. And the assignments that I actually follow through are usually ones that I've suggested myself, because people say, well, what would you like to write about? I'd like to write about that, please, which is great because it allows me sort of free rein. I don't think I'm the right person to ask, to be honest, because maybe can you sort of try and tease a bit more out of me by...
I mean, okay, so, you know, if we win two tickets to Italy tomorrow for a week or 10 days, all expenses paid, and I'm going to let you choose the itinerary. Where would your, outside of Piemonte, where would your first stops be? Not just for the wine and the food, but just for the general, just the whole thing, not just wine related.
Not just wine related? Oh, golly.
Yeah, I mean, just knowing you've got great wine, lovely food, lovely landscape, everything that you would want to relax whilst enjoying the fruits of the knowledge of your trade.
Verona's always a big choice for me. I love Verona. There are certain places that I would always go back to. There, one of my favourite restaurants is up in Valpolicella. You possibly know it. It's if you know the Nagra Valley, little village up in the Nagra Valley called Torbe. There's a restaurant there called Trattoria Caprini at Torbe. It's just one of my favourite places to be. It's a wholly unpretentious restaurant. It's very much cucina casalinga. They make their own pasta, which is just absolutely glorious pasta. They make it fresh every day. And the food is wholly uncomplicated. For a starter, you'll get, you know, something like a sorpresa with homemade giardiniera. And what better starter is than that? Followed by a plate of glorious pasta with, you know, a very sort of traditional meat sauce. Nothing complicated, nothing particularly sophisticated about it. But the icing on this particular cake is that they have a great wine list, and you can drink some wonderful Valpolicella up there from smaller growers who are making really good stuff. I love that place. And while we're in Verona, I'd probably take you to meet, do you know Giovanni Edarle? He's a guy with a small winery and a little forestiera up on the hill around Torricella, overlooking Verona, overlooking the Centro Storico there. And that's, I think it's on the hill between Quinzano and Avesa. And he's right on the limits of the Valpolicella denomination, makes glorious Valpolicella up there. You can stay there. It's where I always stay when I go to Vinitaly. And it's got the most amazing view down over the hillside, overlooking the Centro Storico of Verona. So there's something about Verona that really captures my imagination, both as a place. I love the wines there, obviously, and there's some great places to eat there. So we'd certainly stop there.
Amarone. How do you get on with Amarone?
How do I get on with Amarone? Well, I wrote a book about it. I think the best description I heard of Amarone was by the venerable. He's even older than I am, but he's also much smarter and much wealthier. Sandro Boschini of Marzi. he reckons Amarone's a niche wine, and he's hit the nail on the head there. It's become a huge commercial success. It's produced now in vast quantities compared with what it used to be made. And yet at the same time, you know, its very production method would work against it being a wine that is available in large quantities. So it's a really, it's an unusual wine, and that has all sorts of repercussions and statements to make about, you know, what is wine and how it's made and what it's made for. On a more personal level, I'd sooner drink a good Valpolicella any day, really. Amarone, it's a really fascinating wine, but it's something that personally I would sort of only drink a few times a year. And then, you know, what circumstances would I drink it in? That's the other thing about it. It's so difficult to match with food. When there are a few classic dishes, obviously, like risotto alla Amarone or the classic one of pastizzata, which is cooked with Amarone, or brasato alla Amarone, obviously, is that as well. But I like Amarone best if I've had a hearty lunch, and in the evening, well, I might be a bit peckish, but I don't want to eat a lot. I'll just have some crackers and cheese. That's when Amarone comes into its own. It's a wonderful wine with cheese, but with most other foods, it's just too big and too richly flavoured. So I see it as very much a niche wine. It's a really interesting wine made in a completely unique way, but it is a wine that is perhaps at its best if viewed as a niche wine. Valpolicella is a different story. As I said, one of the world's great and most underestimated red wines.
What about Suave? Obviously, that's a big region, a big production, and a complicated production area. Are there particular styles of Suave, either from altitude or from soil types, that you particularly like? Or is it still, for you, the most important stylistic driver is the producer, him or herself?
I think, it's a really perceptive question. I mean, obviously, the sort of best wines come from the best producers, and hopefully, when they have the right sort of vineyards, it takes you towards the kind of the apogee of the denomination. Suave, when it's good, is so good. You think of something like Gini Salvarenza. That's one particular style that I think it illustrates one particular side of Suave, and it's a side that perhaps people aren't quite so familiar with. It can be a wine that ages wonderfully in bottle and just gets better and better. And I don't know if you've been lucky enough to taste sort of older vintages with Gini, but even the basic wine can last for up to 20 years, you know, and indeed improve over a long period. So that's one side, perhaps the less well-known side of Suave, but I also love the sort of the simpler styles, the less complicated styles, if you like. They're all about kind of freshness and elegance, and freshness and elegance is, you know, what Italy does best, both better than anyone else, in my view. And those are the two qualities that I perhaps appreciate more in wine than any others.
So I know that you travel a lot, and you're always busy lad, you know, judging and writing and all the rest of it. Your hinterland, if I got you correctly, you are a lifelong supporter of Manchester United Football Club. And the final question today: who is your favourite Manchester United player of all time, and why?
Okay, my favourite—that's a really easy one. Bear in mind that I've been very lucky. I first went to Old Trafford in 1961. Yeah, that's a long time ago, isn't it? Golly, that's a long time ago—nearly 60 years ago. So I've seen some of the greats there. I saw Best, Charlton, obviously, and more recently players like Ronaldo. My favourite ever Manchester United player was Eric Cantona, merely because he played with such swagger. He was a flawed genius, and that was always close to my heart. And I think geniuses should have a flaw. No one achieves perfection. But he came very close to it on the pitch. He was majestic. And what I particularly admired about him was that the effect he had on his teammates. In four of the five seasons that he was at Old Trafford, we won the league. The only reason we didn't in the other season was because he was missing for most of it after being suspended for his karate kick. So he had this amazing ability to make the team gel, and the younger players around him he'd show faith in them and they'd respond in kind by sort of playing out of their skins. The effect he had on players like David Beckham and Paul Scholes, I think, you'd be unwise to underestimate the effect that playing alongside Eric Cantona had on great players like that. So no hesitation there. Eric's was the man for me.
Okay, no hesitation at all there.
None whatsoever, no. I mean, there are other great players. I've mentioned some of them. I'd sort of throw in a mention for Roy Keane while I was there. Not always the most popular guy around, not always the most subtle either, but he was a player to be reckoned with. And surprisingly, as a footballer per se, underrated, because he was better known for sort of other aspects of his footballing career. But he was a player that was very underestimated as well. But Eric Cantona is the one that I would keep with me.
Thanks, Michael. I just want to say thanks, Michael Garner, for taking us on a little tour around not just the inner workings of the UK wine trade, but also around some of his favourite spots in Italy. And thanks for coming on the Italian Wine Podcast and sharing your wealth of knowledge. We've only tapped into a tiny part of that, so we may have to get you back again at some stage. Okay? You all right for that, Michael?
Yeah, no problem, Monty. Always a pleasure.
Nice to talk to you.
Okay.
Thanks, Michael.
My pleasure. I hope to see you again before too long. Bye.
Listen to the Italian Wine Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Himalaya FM, and more. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. Until next time, cin cin.